Hello, welcome to the Majlis, a Central Asia podcast at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. I'm Mohammed Tahir, your host here in Washington, D.C. Tajikistan has not been so tolerant place against people who has difference of opinion with its long-time president, Emomali Rahmon. The political intolerance has recently intensified as the only Islamic political party in Central Asia was banned, and hunt for political opponents took a new start in the country. Since then, tens of people were detained and hundreds of people escaped the country, often ending up at the Poland's border with Belarus. And there, those asylum seekers face enormous challenges, both possibility of rejection by the Polish authorities and threat of extradition by the Minsk to Tajikistan. Today in the Central Asia podcast, the Majlis, we will discuss the impact of renewed political repression on Tajikistan. To discuss the subject from Canada, I have Edward Lemon, Tajikistan researcher at the Exeter University. From Berlin, I have researcher and journalist Jan Matusovic, who is also author of the recent feature on The Diplomat about problems of Tajik asylum seekers in Polish-Belarusian border. From Prague, my colleague Bruce Panier is joining me, who is the editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Central Asia blog called Kishlak Awazi. Welcome, gentlemen, to the Majlis.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Jan, let's start with you. What's really happening in the Polish-Belarusian border involving Tajik asylum seekers these days?
Well, over the last 1.5 years, as the crackdown has intensified in Tajikistan on opposition parties, most notably the Islamic Renaissance Party, we've seen a surge in the number of Tajik asylum seekers making their way to Poland via Belarus at a specific border crossing in Brest, on the Brest-Tiraspol border crossing. And what we've observed over this time period is that basically Tajik asylum seekers went from being non-existent in Poland to over 500 in 2015, and already in the first half of this year, they've gone over 660 asylum seekers. So they're currently making their way through. There are a lot more people that would like to cross but are being prevented from doing so by the Polish authorities.
Any idea about the identities or the political opinions of those people?
So it varies. I mean, based on their asylum claims, most people have some sort of affiliation with either the Islamic Renaissance Party or the Group 24. But this affiliation can vary. So some people were party members or somehow directly involved in their activities. Others are just family members or even, you know, have just some sort of, even the slightest connection with these groups can potentially put them in danger.
Poland is a kind of unlikely destination for asylum seekers. We have seen that from recent influx of migrants from Middle East to Europe, with obvious economic reasons, I believe. Then why Tajiks are coming to Poland or trying to get into Poland? Ian.
Well, from what I've seen, I mean, people have left in haste. Many of them have court orders in hand from Tajikistan, so they left in a hurry, in fear for their safety. And Poland just happens to be the closest EU border that they can get through, transiting through Russia and Belarus without a visa.
Edward, Tajik citizens are, because of the historical reasons, tend to go to Russia in thousands and millions. Why not just to go to Russia, not any other country?
Well, I think Russia is no longer safe for Tajik opposition members, Tajiks who've been accused of Islamic extremism. I mean, from public sources, I've compiled a database of 50 incidents in which the Tajik security services have deployed themselves abroad. Now, 36 of these incidents since 2002 have occurred in Russia. So Russia, you know, is the site that has traditionally hosted the most Tajik dissidents, but it's a place that is very unsafe for them. And this is something, as Jan said, the situation is becoming a lot more dangerous. Out of the 50 incidents, 32 of them have happened in the past 2 years. So we've seen a real increase since 2014 in the targeting of opposition activists. So there is a credible case to be made that Russia is not a safe place for these people.
Bruce, yesterday we were talking about this. It looks like even Belarus is not safe. Yesterday you were mentioning few rejected cases or few extraditions to Tajikistan or a few other countries.
There have been incidents where people who were trying to get out of Tajikistan and hopefully a much safer place in Europe have been detained in Belarus. You know, the one case with Shabnam ended happily, I suppose you could say, because she did finally get to leave Belarus, although there was times where it looked like they might actually honor the extradition request from Tajik authorities. So at least we have one example of someone who well, she was Group 24, and she did successfully make her way to Europe. But, you know, for these people who are detained and kept in this kind of legal limbo for a while of not knowing whether they're going to be sent back or actually approved for travel further on west, you know, obviously this is a horrible experience for them. And with the Belarus government, you never, you know, you just never can be sure exactly what's going to happen. You know, as I said, there was one case where, of course, there was a happy end to it. But we know that Belarus has very strange politics. For instance, the former Kyrgyz president has been a guest there for, you know, 6 years. So with Lukashenko and his government, you just can never be sure that making it to Belarus is going to be distant enough from Tajikistan or Central Asia. And you have no idea if they're going to, you know, is this part of a trend where Belarus will hold them and then move them on west? Or is it a case-by-case basis and they might actually send some people back?
Right, Bruce, this is, you know, example of one case. Jan, in your article on The Diplomat, you say in 2015 there were 3,000 cases in which they were rejected. I mean, asylum application of Tajik citizens were rejected by Poland. So what happened to them?
I have to clarify that a bit. There was, I think the number relates to there were 3,000 attempts. So the problem is that according to international law, an asylum seeker, when they get to the Polish border, they should state their intent to seek asylum at the border, and then they need to go through a specific procedure for them to be considered and their case evaluated. The problem, what's happening on the ground, is that Tajik asylum seekers that are being pushed back, so they're not allowed to go through that procedure, so their documents are not taken, and they're turned back to the Belarusian side, which is a violation of international and European law.
Based on what their applications were often rejected, Jan?
I mean, there was no legal basis. They were never taken in the first point. So what people have been telling me is that they try going by train, because this border crossing is actually a train border crossing. And so they get on the train, they get to the border area, they cross on the Belarusian side, and then once there's this sort of gray area between Belarus and Poland, and this is where they tend to get pushed back. And when they present their passports and try to seek asylum, the Polish border guards stamp a rejection in the middle of their passport, and they try doing this 40 times, 50 times, and up to a point where the passport fills up with rejection stamps and they can no longer give it another attempt. The main issue here is that, you know, out of all these people that have tried to get through to Poland last year, only 527, the number 527 that I mentioned, those are people who actually managed to get through and file their claim. The problem is that most people have not been able to even get to that step.
You know, this number you are talking about, Jan, it's kind of insignificant compared to a flux of refugees that Europe is receiving from here and there, from Syria, from Iraq. Perhaps, Edward, this question might go to you. So why we are even talking about this story today?
Because I think it is unprecedented for Central Asia, or specifically for Tajikistan, whereas, as I said, traditionally the place that hosted dissidents were two places, really, Russia primarily and Turkey. Now, I think the recent incidents, you know, the assassination of Umar Ali Kuvatov, the leader of Group 24 in March 2015, you know, they really indicated that these places are unsafe. So I think, you know, and Jan showed in the article with the statistics, you know, you've got a really large increase in the number of people who are trying to now get to Western Europe, because, you know, there is credible evidence to suggest that Tajikistan security services are unable or find it a lot more difficult to reach them there. So I think for Central Asia and for Tajikistan, this is a new and interesting development.
Bruce, from your sources or information, is it the only Tajiks we see the number of people trying to emigrate to outside of their country, or this is kind of a general trend in Central Asia lately?
Well, as concerns Poland, thanks to Jan, we only really have information about the Tajiks. Certainly there have been other peoples from Central Asia who have tried to get out and face the same problem. And I would single out the Uzbeks, for example, as being equally unsafe on Russian territory. They've had a lot of their certainly dissident and opposition leaders snatched off the street and suddenly returned to Uzbekistan, either because Uzbek SNB agents went to Russia and grabbed them, or because in cooperation with Russian services, the FSB grabbed them and sent them back. But we do, since I am in Europe, in Central Europe, of course, we do see Central Asians that come in that have made it all the way, and their residency status is somewhat vague, to say the least. But I've run into them here even in Prague, so I know that certainly people from Uzbekistan have made it through somebody's border and gotten in this far, although, again, they don't seem to have residency permits, and it's unclear exactly the circumstances of how they were able to travel that far. But, you know, I would suggest, and as we've heard here, that, you know, Russia's no longer safe, Turkey no longer safe. So if people in Central Asia were inclined to try to leave and find a safe place to resettle, it's pretty much, you know, obviously, for obvious reasons, China's not any option. Mm. Middle East doesn't seem to be much of an option, so you're left with Europe all of a sudden. And depending on the ability of some of these people, like from Tajikistan, to make it across the border and be able to settle more or less permanently, semi-permanently here, word will get out. And you could expect that this is only the start of what will be many more Central Asians that will, in dire circumstances, try to make it all the way into Europe as being probably the only or certainly the best hope they have for getting out and staying safe.
Interesting point, Bruce. Jan, during your research, have you come across with anyone other than Tajik citizen already present in the Polish-Belarusian border?
Well, if you compare it to the other Central Asia countries, there's barely even a trickle. There are a couple, you know, they're in the tens and twenties, the number of asylum seekers from Uzbekistan and Kyrgyzstan, Turkmenistan, and so on. So the numbers are very low. There are, however, I mean, if you look at Europe as a whole, you know, every year there are around, I would say, about 100 Uzbeks or Kyrgyz, actually, who also claim asylum in other places such as Sweden and Poland. Sweden and Germany.
You said about 100.
About 100, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. From each of those countries. It tends to vary. But it's unclear how they make it as far as Sweden or Germany, whether, because many people come in with tourist visas and then overstay and then claim for, then file a claim for asylum. So there's still a lot of research that needs to go into that. But generally speaking, it's not comparable to the number of Tajiks that are coming in through the border. And I think an important point to make also is that among these Tajik asylum seekers, what's really interesting is that they're attempting to claim asylum in, you know, they're really following the procedure. Despite facing all the difficulties at the border, trying again and again to file for asylum at the border as they are supposed to. And what we're not seeing is, so far, we haven't seen many Tajiks try to cross the Belarusian-Polish border irregularly or to somehow circumvent the border crossing. But they're really, you know, they call ahead NGOs in Poland to make sure that they're doing this in the right way, but then find difficulties on the ground in actually making it through.
Thank you very much, Jan Matusovic, for your thoughts. Just to recap, today we are discussing recent flux of Tajik asylum seekers to Poland and their challenges. Discussing the subject with me are from Canada, Edward Lemon, Tajikistan researcher at the University of Exeter in UK, from Berlin, migration researcher and journalist Jan Matusovic, from Prague, Bruce Panier, who is the editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia blog called Kishlak Wazi. I'm Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis here in Washington, D.C. In this part of the Majlis, Central Asia podcast, let's talk about the reason behind all this, behind this trend on the ground. Although compared to refugees coming from the rest of the world to Europe, number of Tajik asylum seekers are insignificant, but it does represent an increasing trend, as you mentioned, Jan, in your article. What is causing to that?
I mean, it seems to be directly related to the crackdown, and I think the numbers really show that. I mean, one can speculate as to what extent all of these people have direct links to the opposition. I think, from my understanding, my opinion, I think most do in some way. There may be a minority of people who kind of may see this, you know, as an opportunity to leave the country because of the crackdown and maybe leave the country for other reasons, given, you know, the difficult economic situation in Tajikistan. But I think overall, these are people with legitimate claims for asylum. And in particular, there was one case of someone who was trying to seek asylum in Poland, who was a security guard for the Islamic Renaissance Party. It was completely apolitical. It was just his job. Mm. But he said that as soon as the party was shut down, he felt like he was potentially, you know, could potentially end up in prison. And what's also interesting is that a lot of people, like I mentioned previously, actually have court orders and documents proving that that they are being pursued by the authorities.
Right. Edward, you follow developments in Tajikistan. As we discussed, as Jan explained, that most of those cases appears to be due to repression that is taking place in Tajikistan, which we have seen in a number of different ways, banning political parties and hunt for their members. So how this repression is reflected within the country among those people who still remains in Tajikistan?
Well, I think for the people who are left behind, I think life is very difficult. I think life is difficult, you know, not only for those who've been detained, not only for those, you know, who fled the country now, but also their families, you know, who've been targeted, some of them detained and often threatened. And, you know, the intimidation of families has, you know, from my research, been a key way in which a number of dissidents have voluntarily, in inverted commas, returned, you know, after their family have faced threats against their safety from the security services. So, you know, there's a very important informal dynamic to the way in which Tajikistan tries to govern the opposition. You know, a lot of it's through these kind of these threats to family, phone calls, surveillance, monitoring. And that really leads them to have a real sense of insecurity, a real sense of being watched if they are living in Tajikistan or if they are living in Russia, where there's so much, so a very strong presence of the Tajik security services. And as Bruce said earlier, a kind of a collaboration between the Russian and Tajik security services.
Bruce, you know, Tajikistan is one of the few countries in Central Asia which went through civil war. And repression has always been kind of a trademark of Rahmon's regime, who was in power for a long time. So what do you see? What is new in this, which is leading to all these discussions?
Well, if I was going to, I suppose I would look at this from the point of view of the likely point of view of the Tajik government. Now, at the time of the civil war, of course, there was an open and hostile opposition who were not welcome and would have been arrested or killed in a moment if they had actually been able to catch up with them. But at least it was kind of an open battlefield. Now, the civil war ended because there was a power-sharing agreement. So you could make the argument that there was an enemy within all of a sudden. And for nearly 20 years, with relatively very few problems, everything seemed to function well. As far as with that partners, the peace accord and the sharing of power and everything, but Rahman's government took a turn. You know, just a couple of years ago, there was always a gradual repression against the Islamic Renaissance Party or against any legitimate opposition group in Tajikistan, but it became much more pronounced just a couple of years ago. And so now you had all these people who were actually inside the country. I mean, a conservative estimate, the government's estimate of how many registered party members there were in the Islamic Renaissance Party was 40,000. I've talked to people from the Islamic Renaissance Party who said it was more like 80,000 or 100,000. Now you add family members in, and we're well over 500,000 all of a sudden who were living in Tajikistan. Group 24 was a much smaller group. And then there's other groups too, Social Democratic Party, you know, anyone who was a legitimate, genuine opposition party. All these people for, you know, the better part of 20 years had no, they were being harassed a little bit and everything, but there was no reason for great concern. And all of a sudden the policy changed. And so you have effectively 10% of the population or pretty close who's suddenly suspect to the government. And naturally, once these campaigns start, you're going to have this huge, knock-on effect of people running out of the country. We also have to remember, too, you know, as Edward mentioned at the start, during the Civil War days, a lot of the opposition people would go to Russia, or the leadership was welcome in Iran. And even among the average people, the villagers and stuff, there was the option of running into North Afghanistan, and all those options are pretty much closed down now. They're left with having to come up with something new. Like I said, as far as the government is concerned and what's going on inside Tajikistan, they've come up with, 10, maybe 15% of the population who they perceive as being opposition or enemy to their government.
Edward, Tajikistan went through lots of difficult days. Banning of political parties, however, hunting down their members is, in this level is kind of new. So did the opposition do anything different which might have alarmed Rahmon?
I think in the specific case of Group 24, the real crackdown came in October 2013. And that was when Umar Ali Khovatov, the leader, maybe went too far and he called for protests in the country and the overthrow of the government. So I think there was a direct provocation there, and immediately, the organization was quickly declared terrorist organization, and there were scores of arrests of activists in Russia who were linked to Group 24. So I think in that case there was a provocation, not a justification, but a provocation. But in the case of the Islamic Renaissance Party, I think, we've discussed this on previous Majlis, it's very difficult to see a specific reason why Rahmon turned against the Islamic Renaissance Party in 2015. They'd always they had their two seats in the parliament. They were critical of the government, but never too critical. They were, they were accommodational. They maintained the status quo. They didn't directly criticize the government. They played into the system. They didn't threaten the regime yet. There was this slow campaign of repression, slow campaign of kind of discrediting the party, which, led to what happened in 2015.
Bruce, so in the face of this heightened repression, is the asylum seeking is the only option victims are choosing to react, or there are also other ways people are reacting to the Tajik government?
So far, I haven't seen any manifestations of anything, any hostile attitude within the country. Of course, you have to remember the Civil War broke out very, very quickly. It was amazing how fast events moved all of a sudden, and I would neither advocate, and I hope that does not happen again. But these people's options are kind of limited, and so one wonders how much patience some of these people are going to have in the future. There was really no reason for the Tajik government to react the way it has in the last couple of years toward potential perceived political opponents and act against their families. Like I said, I haven't seen any indication yet that people are starting to lose their patience. I think everyone who's been linked with one of these groups at one time or another is just living in fear and hoping that somehow they'll get passed by without anything happening to them. But the campaign is still going on and it's expanding, and we'll just have to see. I would hope that the people in the Tajik government, and particularly President Rahmon, would remember the days of the Civil War and do something to, all possible to avoid provoking exactly that kind of event from happening again.
Edward Bruce says the campaign continues. So, as a result of this heavy crackdown against his opponents or perceived opponents by the Tajik leader, these days there is no opposition left in the country, isn't it? In these circumstances, do you perceive the heavy hand of the Tajik authorities to continue?
Yes, I think we'll see a continued close regulation of religious expression, for example. That is this kind of this bogeyman against which the government has been fighting. I think we'll see a continuation of that. And I think, the legitimation of an authoritarian government is always going to be based on the construction of an enemy. So they need someone to say, look, we are protecting you against the West's influence. You know, we're protecting you against the influence of radical Islam. You know, so they're always going to need some kind of enemy. Otherwise, Rahman's regime will, you know, struggle to kind of hold some kind of legitimacy. So I think that the campaign against opponents will continue indefinitely.
So who do you see is the potential opponent going forward?
Well, I think, you know, in recent weeks they've turned to the internet, you know, as well, not in recent weeks, really, for a longer amount of time. You know, I think the social media is really a place where a more open political discussion is taking place. And there's been, you know, along with these website blockings, there've been a number of arrests recently that I've seen, you know, of people who've merely watched or liked a video created by the Islamic State. You know, so it seems like opponents can be anyone. It can be a 17-year-old boy sitting in, you know, in a village watching a video, could suddenly become labeled as an extremist. So it seems like they're casting the net very widely, and, you know, and arresting all kinds of people who perhaps don't even have a political position.
Bruce, let's conclude this here. Who do you see as a potential target going forward?
Well, I mean, they have this very loose definition of Salafis all of a sudden, and they've certainly netted quite a few people, including imams, on charges that they are members of or involved with Salafists somewhere in the country. This is kind of a new trend for Tajikistan. That name didn't appear so much even as of a few years ago. You never heard this, but it's kind of snowballing now. We see a lot more of that. There are still people who are associated with the Islamic Renaissance Party of Tajikistan who are in the country and so far haven't been touched. And I would mention Hoxha Akbar Turajonzadeh, who the government has never particularly trusted for all these years. He was the number two guy in the IRPT way back in the Civil War days. He's been living in Tajikistan, but he's still got a pretty big, sizable support base. He's would be the big fish. I would think that arresting him might be a tipping point where there would be some kind of popular unrest sparked by that. They might leave him alone, but they've never left him totally alone anyway since he's been in the country. Every now and then, someone kind of throws out an accusation against him, and they wait and see how that settles with society. And so far, people have shrugged that off and not placed any credence in these vague accusations. But he is still in the country. And if they were looking for an enemy, he's an enemy from way back.
Right. Very bleak picture. Bruce Panier, the editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Central Asia blog called Kishlag Awazi, thank you for your insightful thoughts. Also, Edward Lemon, Tajikistan researcher at the Exeter University in England, and from Berlin, migration researcher and journalist Jan Matusovic. Once again, gentlemen, thank you for being available to the Majlis today.
Thank you.
This is it from me, Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis, the Central Asia podcast at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. Bye-bye.